Today's movie discussion on Women Inherit the Earth takes us into a future many of us have actually visualized or dreamed about, unlike in Terminator or Alien. It's that wacko future with flying cars. Having grown up during the Jetsons era, Beth was fascinated by how the film envisioned it actually working. The other half of our discussion will no doubt be devoted to Beth gushing over Gary Oldman. So, let's get into it.
Hello and welcome to Woman Inherits the Earth, a mother-daughter podcast about the representation of women in movies and television. I am Tessa Dare, a writer and the author of the paranormal mystery series The Karanzen Chronicles, and Beth's daughter.
And I am Beth Von Baron, Tessa's mother, and also a writer. In this podcast, we discuss women and film. Today, we are discussing The Fifth Element. The French title is Le Cinquième Element. It was made in 1997. The director is Luc Besson. Screenplay by Luc Besson, Robert Mark Kamen. And the story is by also by Luc Besson. Running time is 2 hours, 6 minutes. It's a Columbia Pictures movie. The music is by Eric Serra. Never heard of him. Special visual effects are by Mark Stetson. Never heard of him, but they were very good. Director of photography is Thierry, T-H-I-E-R-R-Y, Arbogast. Thierry or Thierry, not sure. Stars Bruce Willis as Corbin Dallas, Gary Oldman as Zorg, Ian Holm, again, we've had Ian Holm in a couple of movies, as Cornelius, Mila Jovovich as Lilu, Chris Tucker as Ruby Rod. Was his name Rod or Rode? Rod, I think.
I think it's Rod, Ruby Rod. Okay.
And a very short scene with heartthrob Luke Perry as Billy.
He gets weirdly high billing considering that it's like kind of a cameo. He's only in the one scene. Yeah.
He had really high billing for just this one scene. I think at the time this was made, though, he was a big star. A big heartthrob, yeah. So he might have gotten people to go watch it. Anyway, it opens in Egypt, 1914. Tess, take it away.
All right, yeah, I'm going to do the summary. It's a little long, and I apologize, but there are a lot of things happening in this movie, and I wasn't sure which things you could cut out without making it make no sense. And it doesn't make a lot of sense as is, which I say as someone who loves this movie. It's not the most sensical movie on the planet.
No, it's not. But I love it too, so it's okay.
The Fifth Element takes place in a universe where, for an unknown reason, a great evil planet made of fire and lava appears every 5,000 years and tries to destroy the Earth. An alien species called the Mondashiwans have, for some reason, decided to protect the Earth from this evil, and in 1914, they show up in ancient Egypt to take the weapon that will defeat it in order to keep it safe. The weapon works by using a combination of the four elements, earth, wind, fire, and water, and an unknown fifth element that appears to be kept safe in a sarcophagus. This is the scene that has Luke Perry in it. He's the assistant to an archaeologist who is quote-unquote discovering this thing. And then we cut to 300 years later. The ball of fire appears, and all attempts to destroy it only make it stronger. A priest named Vito Cornelius tells the president of Earth about the Mondashiwans and their weapon, so the president allows the Mondashiwans to enter Earth's space territory. Unbeknownst to them, however, a ruthless capitalist named Zorg, who is for some reason working with the fireball, has hired warriors known as Mangalores to intercept the Mondashiwans, and they destroy their ship and just about everyone on it. Shortly after that, the Earth's government does discover a single survivor from the Mondashiwan ship in the form of a hand. They literally find, like, a hand in the ship, which they use their, like, future technology to, quote-unquote, reconstitute the being it belonged to. It's a very, like, kind of magical sci-fi mm-hmm. thing. It looks mm-hmm. to me like they're just cloning it.
Yeah, but it doesn't... But when she comes out, she looks nothing like the creatures that had been there, so...
Yeah, so the Mondashiwans, as we see them, are like these giant metal creatures, but that might be armor? I don't know.
It could be. You're right.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, random sci-fi terminology, and not all of it necessarily makes sense, and not all of it needs to, you know?
No,
you
just... It's a fable.
Yeah. It was weird to watch this movie this time, trying so hard to, like, make sense of what was happening, because normally when I watch this movie. I just kind of let it wash over me. And anything that doesn't make sense, whatever.
It's full of beautiful photography, fun acting, and Bruce Willis. So, you know, anything you see, you can say what you will about the kinds of movies Bruce Willis makes, but he is so much fun. He is so fun to watch.
He's great in this movie. Yeah.
So fun to watch, and he's great in this movie.
And this is like prime era Bruce Willis. This is like, we're not that far off from Die Hard. This is also around the time that he made 12 Monkeys. This is just like the Bruce Willis prime. And he's great in it. He's very fun to watch in this movie. All right. So they reconstitute this being who is believed to be the inhabitant of the sarcophagus, aka the fifth element needed for the weapon. Turns out that this is a young woman named Lilu with extremely orange hair, played by Mila Jovovich. Freaked out by the fact that they have for some reason trapped her in a transparent tube while a bunch of old dudes stand around and gawk at or tease her, Lilu breaks the hell out of there and makes a run for it, eventually jumping off of a building and landing in the cab of Corbin Dallas, played by Bruce Willis. And by landing in, I mean crashing through the roof of his cab.
The flying cab.
The flying cab, yeah. And it's a nonsensical scene, but it is very cool to look at because you literally get her like standing on the side of this building. The buildings are so high up that you literally like can't see the ground. And in fact, we never see the ground of New York City in this whole movie.
And in fact, I get the impression that he does go low a couple times and it looks really smoggy and
yes,
and
he calls it the dirty fog.
So it could be that they're all living up above the bad atmosphere is my thinking on this.
Yeah, the vague impression that you get is that they've continued to build New York City upward to get above the smog, and like even when they go down into the fog, as he calls it, which appears to be like the lowest that anyone ever goes, even that is not the ground. So it just sort of feels like we're building city on top of city or whatever.
When she jumps out of the window, I think my thinking is, oh, she's gonna be fine. I don't know why I think that, but she feels like a superhero. She feels like somebody who could crash into something and survive.
Yeah, I mean, they have essentially told us at this point that she is a superhero. Like, they say that she is the, like, reconstituted form of the person in the sarcophagus, who they have repeatedly referred to as, like, the perfect warrior. In the scene where they reveal her in the tube, all of these creepy old dudes are going around, like, breathlessly talking about how perfect she is, which, before they reveal that she's a woman, is all around, like, oh, she's the perfect warrior, the perfect specimen. And then they reveal that she's a woman, and all of a sudden it turns very, like, leering, and, like, she's so hot. But you don't lose that, like, she is this perfect warrior person. Also, before she breaks out of the tube, they tell you that it is unbreakable glass, and then she just punches through it.
Right.
So she's going to be fine.
She's going to be fine, yeah.
But it's a very cool moment when she, like, jumps off the building, because they do this shot from above where you see her, like, diving, like she's diving into a pool over this swarm of flying cars, basically. And then she crashes into the cab. Dallas is immediately smitten with her, partly because, you know, she's clearly in distress, but it seems pretty clear from the jump that he's a little bit attracted to her. So he agrees to help her and burns the last few remaining points on his license to help her escape. And thus the plot commences. So all of that is kind of the first, like, 10, 15 minutes of the film where we're just setting everything up. And now our two main characters have finally met. They then reunite with the priest and learn that the stones that they will need to activate the weapon have actually been entrusted to an opera singer named Plava Laguna. I'm just going to refer to her as the opera singer, most likely. So that they need Lilu, but they also need the stones for the weapon. Everyone is after the stones. Turns out the opera singer has the stones. At the same time, the government learns the same thing, and they end up contracting Corbin Dallas to go after the stones as well. This is another sort of unexplained moment in the movie. The stones are what Lilu is after, and so he wants to stay with Lilu. So he was kind of probably going to go after the stones anyway, but also at the same time, the government, who does not know that he has been in contact with Lilu, decides that he's their ex-military guy that they're going to send after these stones. It's just kind of like a a coincidence in the story.
You just have to suspend disbelief.
You just got to roll with it. So the government contracts him, and the way that they decide to get him to where the opera singer is going to be is that they rig this huge radio contest to win him some plane tickets to what turns out to be a, like, floating spaceship hotel where the opera singer is set to perform. So, through a continuing haze of hijinks, Dallas and Lulu eventually get on the plane slash spaceship.
You have to go over the scene where they're trying to get the tickets. And how many people try to get the multipass? I don't even know anymore.
Yes, like, okay.
A dozen?
I wasn't going to go over this because my summary is already so long. But yeah, there's like this sort of French farce scene in the essentially airport. They keep referring to it as a plane, but it is a spaceship. But whatever. It's an airport where you like catch your spaceship
to go wherever.
It's a flying
spatial cruise ship.
But also they're going to a different, like the hotel is also a spaceship.
Yeah.
But they have to take a plane.
Interstellar cruise ship.
Yeah, there's a lot of spaceships in this spaceship movie, surprisingly.
If you've ever seen a cruise ship, they have lots of little boats, too.
Yeah.
So that's kind of very realistic. You know. Anyway, go ahead.
But yeah, so Dallas and Lulu are trying to get onto the ship, but first the priest knocks Dallas unconscious and tries to send his assistant instead, but Dallas catches him and takes his place, and then after they've left, there's like one other guy who thinks that Dallas is dead and thinks that he has his ticket and tries to get on the ship, but the woman taking his ticket knows that he's actually a Mangalore, because the Mangalores are able to like change their shape, so he ends up running off before he can get caught, and then like a third person who's been hired by Zorg also tries to pretend to be Dallas to get on the ship, fails, and then gets immediately blown up by Zorg, who I guess has like planted a bomb on him in case he did fail. And that all kind of culminates in this frenetically cut scene where the ship is taking off, and also there's a bomb exploding, and also the priest is simultaneously sneaking onto the ship. Like I said, there's a million things happening in this movie at once, and you
all
don't...
the time. And they're cutting back and forth and back and forth and back and forth between all these scenes. And it's easy to keep up with. You can keep up with
it. Yeah, for sure.
But trying to describe it in retrospect is another thing.
I feel like part of the reason that it's easy to keep up with is just as long as you understand what Dallas and Lulu are doing, you kind of don't need to understand what anyone else is doing.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Like a lot of it ends up just kind of resolving itself.
It's almost like a Keystone Cops thing going on here.
Yeah.
You know, all these different people, like you said, frenetically acting in different ways, and it all kind of comes together. And this continues. This frenetic activity continues from this point on almost to the end of the movie.
So. Yeah, which I think is part of why the movie is enjoyable, because I think the fact that mm-hmm. it comes at you at this breakneck pace means that you don't really have time to sit down and try to figure out what these broader things are supposed to mean, because they don't mean anything. It's fine. Just let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they get on the spaceship, at which point they are intercepted by Ruby Rod, played by Chris Tucker, who is a like crazy flamboyant, overtly sexual radio host who apparently plans on interviewing Dallas all throughout this trip that he's won. I just gotta say, like, Chris Tucker's performance as Ruby Rob is incredible, and I think the other thing that
amazing.
Makes this movie work.
And I don't think I've seen him in a lot of stuff, but he's never done anything else like this that I know of. So
I mean, very few people have. This is like a wild role that I don't know.
It's a crazy wild.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know what else is comparable to it. All right, so they do get to the spaceship hotel, at which point Lulu and Dallas end up separated, and this is when the Mangalores decide to attack. They're mad because Zorg stiffed them after they killed the Mondashiwans because they brought him the case that he was asking for, but it did not have the stones inside of it. So he didn't want to pay them, and instead he like blew a bunch of them up. So they decided that they're now going to get the stones in order to force him to pay them, I think.
I will say that the only creatures, only beings in this movie who get killed are the bad guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and there's and the kind of, there's like two sets of bad guys, two groups, and they kill each other off.
Yeah.
So We never feel bad about them leaving the scene.
Yeah, like there are a lot of like firefights in this movie, but you don't really see a lot of civilians actually die. And like everyone that you
people.
Yeah, everyone that you do see die is either like an assassin or a mm-hmm. hired killer of some other kind of hired killer or Zorg. Okay, so meanwhile, Zorg has also shown up on the hotel spaceship, also trying to get the stones. So Leeloo ends up in a firefight with some of the Mangalores in the opera singer's room because they're looking for the stones, and she defeats all of them, but then Zorg comes in and also starts firing a gun at her. Meanwhile, Dallas is watching the opera singer's actual performance, which is very cool. Honestly, one of my favorite parts of the movie is this
It's the best.
Moment. Yeah. They keep cutting back and forth between the opera singer's crazy cool performance and Leeloo fighting these guys in the opera singer's room, and there's this very clear parallel between the two of them. Leeloo's fight is very highly choreographed, and it kind of ends with her like throwing her arms out just as the opera singer throws her arms out. Also, the opera singer is maybe one of my favorite designs in the movie because she's this like weird blue alien that is simultaneously like kind of pretty but kind of bizarre, and she sings like a traditional opera at first, but then it gets this kind of like house beat put under it, so it's like simultaneously an opera but also very like 90s music.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's incredibly beautiful, and I think one of the many points I think the filmmaker is making in the movie is how important artistry is.
Yeah,
because they talk up and this woman's the sounds that she's making as a singer, because sometimes it doesn't sound like a voice. It's hard to say. It's just beautiful. Otherworldly. It's kind of otherworldly. It's so beautiful. And then at some point she stops and goes into this beat, like,
yeah.
And it sounds a little bit like rock beat, pop beat, but it's also still has a classical feel to it.
Yeah.
So it's just, the music is incredible. It's maybe the only music in the film, really. And it's just beautiful. So, and then when she is killed, that's a very sad moment because they are killing beauty.
Yeah. So, yeah. So then after her performance is over, the Mangalores also attack the opera hall or the performance hall, and they end up killing her. I guess she's actually probably the one like good person who dies.
Yeah, I was just thinking that she's the only one, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except for at the very beginning, the priest in the very beginning of the film, he gets killed, I think.
It's a little unclear, but I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. But Luke Perry doesn't. His character survives. But
also,
yeah.
To be honest, I don't know. I would make an argument that, like, we're talking about a man in a like British man in the 1900s doing an archaeological dig in Egypt for the sake of enriching himself. How good of a person is he? I'm not saying that the film is trying to like make a comment about him, but it is interesting to me that at that moment the aliens are there to remove the weapon in order to protect it, which I do think implies that they don't trust the people of Earth not to like dismantle it. And they're right.
I think the priests are, at the beginning, he's an archaeologist priest, but he's looking for the thing.
There's two different characters. There's the priest and there's the archaeologist. The priest is the one who kills the archaeologist if he dies.
Oh, okay. All right. Because the priest is actually trying to save the world.
Yes. I mean,
his whole goal, his whole focus. Okay. Yeah. And then Luke Perry is just somebody's assistant.
He's the archaeologist's assistant. All right. Anyway. Okay. So the Mangalore shoot the opera singer and Dallas tries to save her, but she's already been shot. And with her dying breath, she informs him that the stones are hidden inside her body. So Dallas digs the stones.
Because of course they are.
Yeah. Because of course they are. I mean, to be fair, she did successfully hide them from all of the bad guys. So Dallas digs the stones out of her body and manages to take out most of the Mangalores in the room while also keeping Ruby Rod safe. And there's a little bit of slapstick in there as well. But basically everything gets resolved. And then Dallas and Ruby Rod and the priest find Lilu in the room where she has been attacked by Manglers and Zorg, and she is traumatized or something. She's gone sort of catatonic, so they have to carry her out, and Ruby Rod sees a bomb timer, basically, and they realize that someone who is Zorg has set a timed bomb for the hotel. So all four of them, Dallas, Lilu, Ruby Rod, and the priest, flee the hotel. They actually get on Zorg's spaceship and flee the hotel. Meanwhile, Zorg comes back because he realizes that the thing that he took out of her room also doesn't have the stones in it. He turns off his device, but almost as soon as he does, the last living Manglore turns on a different timed device that almost immediately blows up. So Zorg is done.
And the whole ship is destroyed. Yeah. But all of the people on the ship get off, successfully get evacuated. And I think it's a very important point to make, because this film is not about murder and mayhem. It's about mayhem. But they're not trying to kill innocent people. All those people on the ship are kind of frivolous, but they're there to have a good time.
Yeah.
And every last one of them gets off the ship, so that's really good.
Yeah, like, I kept telling my partner, like, it feels like this movie is like a live-action cartoon. Like, we do want zaniness to ensue, but we don't really want there to be a real death toll. This is a very, like, this is a fun movie. It does not want to get that serious.
And actually, because of that environment or that atmosphere in the film, when the opera singer is killed, it's a very sad moment.
It feels very tragic,
Yeah, it's a contrast to the rest of the film.
They also do an interesting editing thing there where, because they're editing back and forth between her and Lilu during the fight, and then when she gets shot, it cuts to Lilu, and Lilu, like, sobs. The implication being that she somehow, like, psychically knows that the opera singer, has died. And that is part of what starts her little, like, existential crisis slash catatonic state that then brings us into the finale. So on the ship, our main four heroes take it to Earth, specifically to Egypt, where they also meet up with the priest's assistant. And they go around activating the weapon. They put the stones in their spots. And then they discover that each one has to be activated by an actual example of the element. So you have to, like, throw dirt on the earth one. You have to blow on the wind one. The priest uses his flop sweat to put water on the water. He literally just, like, rubs a towel on his face and then squeezes it out.
It's clever.
Over the water
it's
one.
Very clever.
And then Ruby Rod is supposed to activate the fire one, but he doesn't have any fire, so he freaks out and he's like, Corbin, I got no fire, man. And Corbin, who is a smoker, which has been established multiple times in the movie, comes over. And also, I want to note, he has one match left, which has also already been established. They show him burning his second to last match, which is just an unnecessary detail, but they put it in there. Like, this has been set up. Anyway, so but he does manage to strike the match and slowly lower it down, so that one activates. But unfortunately, Lilu is having an existential crisis. But hey, happily for us, the cure is making out with Bruce Willis on a plinth, and humanity is saved. Technically, it's love. I don't know. I do think that the ending is kind of the silliest part of the movie. She's freaking out, and maybe in part because of the opera singer dying, but also because in her study of what humanity's been up to for the last 5,000 years, she finally reached war, and that depressed her so much that she's like, what's the point? And the cure is Bruce Willis saying, I love you, even though they've known each other for approximately 3 hours.
But he senses that she needs to hear that. She needs to feel a connection to what she's doing.
I guess.
These people... To humanity. She needs to feel a connection to humanity so she can save them. But what was interesting to me about that scene where they're all trying to get the four elements in place, and then she's the fifth one, and I wrote in my notes at the beginning of the movie and in that scene, here we go, we've got our Indiana Jones moments here. So at the very beginning, it's very Indiana Jones-like, and then at the end, they're doing impossible things to get the whole thing to work, which is what Indiana Jones does in all of his movies. So anyway, but and that's okay. But also the other, the Mummy series of movies, yeah. It reminded me of that too, because of being, you know, secret rooms and in Egypt and stuff. So lots of influences here, but it has a good ending.
There were a lot of movies in the 90s that were like sort of fixated on Egypt. There was this movie, there was the Mummy movies. There was also the original Stargate movie, which is also fixated on Egypt and is all born out of Egyptian mythology.
The TV show.
Then the TV show, which ended up doing a lot more stuff, but the original concept is Egyptian mythology. So that's pretty much my summary.
So my summary was much shorter. In a mythology-fueled storyline, an ancient prophecy says a big bad thing is coming to exterminate all life in the universe. The story has been passed down by priests protected by robotic species. The how do you pronounce that? Mandashiwan?
Okay, I think it's Mandashiwan. It is not spelled that way.
No, but it's not.
But that's what it sounds like they're saying.
So the newest priest, Ian Holmes' father Vito, says only one thing can prevent it, the supreme being, the fifth element created to protect life, along with the other four elements. I might have copied this from somewhere. I don't think I wrote this, but this is a much shorter version. Anyway, the Mandashiwan come to Earth, but are destroyed by Zorg soldiers. Their DNA is used to create Lilu, and on we go. So I think I might have, I don't think I wrote that, but I honestly can't remember. Anyway, but it's also set in Brooklyn, that when you're talking about New York, it's South Brooklyn.
It's Brooklyn,
but they actually gave it a, the whole flying cars thing in this movie, in those early scenes where things are going alongside buildings, you've got tracks and things are flying. It just seems very roller coaster like.
The whole early
scenes. Yeah. So it's like we've become a roller coaster culture by the 27th century, but it is still what the police chasing him in the flying cars. Great chase scene. And then noticing during that chasing how polluted the earth is. So that's not a good vision of the future for sure. I read a little bit about the film before we started talking, and Luc Besson has made about 20 films since his debut in 1981, including Subway in 1985, La Femme Nikita in 1990, some documentaries, some animated films. He's also part of what is called the Cinema du Look. And I'm trying to pull from my French knowledge how you pronounce look in this instance. But I think it's just cinema du look. So, which is a movement that, just as it sounds, favors style over substance, spectacle over narrative, according to Wikipedia, which is pretty accurate for the style that he's going for. But Luc Besson himself has rejected the label. So it's a very stylistic film. I love the style. I love his approach. He may be rejecting it because people are saying there's no story here, or that there, you know, it's not whatever. But I think there is a good story here, and it does have themes. The characters are pretty well developed, considering how little time actually, goes by in the film. So, but I like this. The plane, there's just a lot of little things. So like when they go out to the planet, quote unquote, they're actually going out to a cruise ship, an interstellar ship that is orbiting a planet.
Yeah.
And at one point they talk about being able to go down to the planet, but they never do in the course of the film. So I don't even know what that's about.
It's called like the Flosston Pleasure Planet or something in the Angel Nebula. And they tell you that there's like 200 beaches on the planet that you can go down to.
Yeah.
But in the course of the movie, we never actually go to the planet at all.
We never see them. And so that raises one question, because there's actually a shuttle, like, you know, the American NASA shuttles, that kind of a vehicle and a plane type shuttle that takes all the passengers out to the cruise ship, interstellar ship that's orbiting the planet. And then presumably at some point the mission was to take them, or the trajectory was to take the people from this cruise ship down to the planet, which never happens because it gets blown up.
Yeah.
But so there's a lot of interesting visuals going on there. The cruise ship itself is pretty crass, but the diva's voice, the opera singer.
Oh, she's fantastic.
She's so beautiful that she kind of is a nice contrast for that crassness on the cruise ship.
So according to Wikipedia, the hotel is meant to be a kind of Club Med in space.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
When the diva is singing, the other thing that I wrote down about this is that everyone on the ship is affected. Either it's going out over speakers or they can just hear her, but everyone is affected.
Yeah, so Ruby Rod is there, and he's broadcasting everything. So I think he's broadcasting her opera not just to the ship, but throughout the galaxy or Earth space or whatever. I think a lot of people can listen in because, like, he's been broadcasting like the whole time, and he's not talking during this performance. So I think he's broadcasting the performance.
So that could be it. And everybody's affected by the beauty and the artistry of this woman's voice. But, you know, there's a lot of space story kinds of things. So the assistant priest, Ian Holmes' assistant.
David.
And Ruby. Yeah, and Ruby both have lightsabers. I don't know if you noticed that or not. But they have these things that look like lightsabers. Yeah. Anyway, so it's a really visually beautiful film. They pull in a lot of science fiction kinds of things that people will recognize, I think, visually.
There are several visual nods to Star Wars, for sure. I mean, the military woman is wearing like a cartoonish version of the Princess Leia space buns.
Yeah, and actually some of the military people themselves look a little bit like they came out of Star Wars. And then there's the Indiana Jones thing. There's a lot of references to modern popular films.
I'm not sure when the term Mandalorian became a part of Star Wars lore, but one of the bad guy species is called the Mangalores, which sounds very similar. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but it is what it made me think of. I also wanted to say the costumes are all designed by Jean-Paul Gaultier.
There you go.
A French haute couture designer is designing all of these costumes. And I feel like not only is the film beautiful, but it's like you can tell that every visual element has been specifically designed. Even if it doesn't necessarily make real world sense, it's still like it makes design sense.
It makes design sense. And I think he is referencing other films. So like the big ship that the bad guys come in on looks like an Imperial cruiser. So
yeah, that's
talking about the costumes.
Yeah.
It looks like an Imperial. I mean, like it was
for sure
taken straight out of Star Wars.
Yeah.
It really does. An interesting thing that's not really a visual is that there's a lot of diversity in this film. It's made in 1997. And if you look at some of the science fiction movies that were made, and you know, or Star Trek, even Star Trek, didn't always have a lot of diversity. It had an Asian person, but who was it? Some famous Latino comic recently said he loved Star Trek when he was growing up, but you watched these TV shows and thought, they're not going to be any Latino people when I get older. We're going to the future.
Well, I mean, I will say,
Latinos in it.
I think that is true. I think that is a blind spot of Star Trek, although there is a Latino character in the current show, Strange New Worlds.
I think it changes, yeah.
But I think for the time, Star Trek actually was incredibly diverse.
It was. And it's just that when you look back on it, it's like, it was diverse.
There were blind spots.
To a point.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were blind spots. And this movie has all kinds of people in it. It's incredibly diverse for 1997.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty astonishing, actually. So.
I did want to say there is one nod, I think, to Star Trek. I mean, probably if I looked over it with a fine-tooth comb, I would find more things. But the one nod to Star Trek specifically, I think, is they have a replicator. There's a moment where Leelu puts some like powder in a bowl and pops it in what looks like a microwave, and it comes out as this like huge roast chicken with like vegetables on the side, makes me laugh because a very similar thing happens in Red Dwarf. And I think honestly this film reminds me of Red Dwarf a lot. I think because both
it does
this film
great point
yeah this film and Red Dwarf are both on the side of like satire and like not taking things as seriously, and so they have like much more much more crazy versions of these technologies, because Red Dwarf has a scene where Lister pours a bunch of powder into a bowl and pops it in a microwave, and 1 second later it has transformed itself into this like huge like three-course meal, which is not exactly how the replicator works. It's like a sillier version of how the replicator works.
Yeah. Well, and like you said earlier, it's like a it's cartoonish. Yes. Because she does it once and she eats the whole chicken and she does it again and she eats the whole chicken.
She keeps eating chicken. Ravenous. Yeah.
She does it two or three times, just keeps eating. And you realize, well, she's a brand new baby. She's just been born. So, yeah, she's
And also, she just like punched her way out of, you know, an unbreakable glass tube and then out of a bit. Like, she punches her way out of the building and then like jumps into a cat. Like, she's had a day, you know?
She has had a day. Yes, she has. And she also has to learn the language.
Yes.
She speaks the divine language, and it is a beautiful language. I probably completely made up language, but the way she's speaking it, it's very pretty.
Yeah, it is a made-up language. However, they did actually, like, it's not just her saying nonsense words. Jovovich and Besson, like, worked together to create this language of about 400 words, and then they would write each other letters to practice it. So she, like, actually became fluent in this, like, fictional language.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty cool. The divine language.
The divine language.
And then they finally fell in love and got married.
We
should throw that in here. But the star and the director did kind of have an affair, during the course of the movie and got married afterwards. So
And then divorced shortly after that.
Very quickly. Very quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. As I told Beth before we started recording, the backstory to this movie just sounds so incredibly French to me. When it started, the director was actually in a relationship with the woman who plays the opera singer. And then he left her for Mila Jovovich during filming. And then shortly after that, got divorced from Mila Jovovich as well.
Yep, absolutely.
I also wanted to say, in that scene where she's making the chicken over and over again, she picks up this device that she's like playing around with, and then she puts it on her face, and then when she takes it off, she has makeup on. It's like a device that like stamps makeup on your face, which I didn't even notice. My partner had to point it out.
That.
Yeah, my partner pointed out to me, and I was like, oh my God, you're right. She was not wearing makeup before. It's like a makeup stamping device.
So here, listeners, the two women in the podcast did not notice the makeup, but the man did.
Oh, gosh.
There's a couple other little things like that. So, like, Corbin's t-shirt and Lilu's hair are the same color.
The same orange.
That already.
Yeah, violent orange.
Oban's accent is this kind of combination of Brooklynese and cowboy Western.
Yeah,
he's got, like, combined these different...
Yeah,
it's a cowboy like sound, but he's definitely got some Brooklyn stuff going on there too. Unless it's just a British actor's way of interpreting a cowboy accent. I don't know. Who knows?
It's
a great accent.
It's very fun. It feels like a mishmash of like masculine American accents. Also, I mean, like, while we're talking about Zorg, I love this movie, but I do think that it is, like I said a little bit at the beginning, it is a kind of movie that is sort of best not to think about too deeply. You know, it's meant to be entertaining, and I think it's beautiful, and the performances are really fun, and if you don't think about it too hard, it's super fun. But since we're here to think about it a little bit too hard, I do think that this movie, I like to think of it as, like, a very 90s movie in that it really wants to have its cake and eat it too. And this kind of applies to everything. And the way that it applies to Zorg is, okay, so Zorg is functionally the biggest bad guy in the movie. Like, not technically it's the big ball of angry evil, but the big ball of angry evil has no personality and only really interacts with Zorg. Like, it gets like one line over the phone with Zorg. You never really understand why Zorg is working with the big ball, what he would really get out of it. It implies that the ball is like paying him, but like, I don't know why the ball would have money. Anyway, because the ball is sort of devoid of personality, Zorg is functionally our main villain. He's our villain who has a personality, and he is explicitly just like an evil capitalist. Like, everything that he does is capitalistic. It's implied that the reason he's working with the ball is for money. He has an exchange with the priest where he's trying to get information out of the priest, and his defense for wanting to do evil stuff is that when you destroy something, you're like creating jobs for people. And it's a very thin defense. And right after he says it, he starts to choke on a cherry that he like stupidly like knocked back. And the priest has this whole moralizing monologue where he's like, oh, so like, where are all of these people who supposedly have these jobs? Where are they now to help you? Before finally hitting him on the back and helping him out. And that is a very clear moment of kind of undercutting this guy's whole capitalistic philosophy. So he's clearly meant to be this evil capitalist. Oh, it's also revealed in a blink and you miss it line that he owns the cab company that Corbin works for and is probably why Corbin gets fired at the beginning of the movie, because they had to lay off 1 million people for profit's sake. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, I would also interject here that Zorg as a character, though he is the bad guy through most of the movie, you don't really dislike him. I mean, he's kind of, it's almost most bad guys, you really, really hate them. He's just a capitalist guy who's made a lot of money and he's willing to kill people to do it. But everybody he kills at the end is pretty much other bad guys. So he's not, I think it's a little sad that he got killed off. I mean, you know, he's irredeemable. He's not going to become a better person. But he's not somebody you dislike.
Yeah, I mean, because he's fun. And Gary Oldman does do a great job of, like, making him silly and stupid, but also charismatic and enjoyable to watch. Mm-hmm. And he does have his weird little naked baby elephant pet. He's got this, like, alien pet that you see him petting, and it looks so bizarre.
It's gross.
It's bizarre. But he, like, there is a scene of him showing it genuine affection. So, like, that's weirdly endearing. But what I want to say is, on the one hand, Zorg is our, like, capitalist villain. On the other hand, we see capitalism in action in many other ways in the film, and those all seem to be an endorsement of capitalism. Like, we see some cops stopping at a McDonald's, and there's, like, a weirdly high amount of McDonald's imagery in the first part of the film. But the woman who waits on them seems perfectly happy to do her job. And then you also see mostly women who work for the airline who all seem super happy to be doing their job. They're always smiling. Mm-hmm. There's no hint of discontent. They don't get their own perspective. They're just kind of there to be, like, happy and sexy and smiling, and there's no critique of that whatsoever, even though these are, like, service positions.
It's a throwback to 1960s stewardesses.
Yes, for sure.
That's how they were presented anyway, for sure, as doing their jobs. I don't know, because I wasn't flying in the 1960s. By the time I was flying, it was stewards and stewardesses who were just flight attendants. And that whole gushy, can I take care of you attitude doesn't really exist anymore. And that's not a bad thing. But yeah, they're very unreal.
Yeah, their outfits are extremely revealing. I mean, they're very interesting looking because it sort of looks like their outfits are made out of latex or something, which is kind of weird. Mm. They're all blue. They have, like, blue eyebrows and blue eye makeup and then these short little, like, bob wigs. Like, they're so identical looking that it's hard to tell them apart, even though they've clearly cast, like, diverse actors to play them. Like, some of them are clearly, like, different races, but they still sort of blend into one because of this uniform. And the film has no critique of that. Like, this is just presented as a positive, fun thing. Look at all these hot women who are here to just do stuff for you. So I just, it's a moment of weird contradiction at the heart of this film, that on the one hand, the uber capitalist is the bad guy, but on the other hand, it's totally fine that all of these women are probably making minimum wage and forced to wear these tight latex outfits, and they're just smiling and happy. They don't have any problem with this job. They're happy to be objectified.
They're a little zombie-ish, like. I think that's true, and they're really the only, other than Lulu, they're really the only women in the movie, except for the singer.
The singer,
who we don't get any kind of a backstory on her, which is unfortunate, because she seems like she would have been an interesting character. And I think one of the police officers is the
woman with the Leia hair, but she never gets a line and is also kind of the butt of a joke. Like, her physical existence is there. She's there so that Bruce Willis can be kind of disgusted at the thought of her, and then she's never seen again.
Yeah.
She's basically there to be like, look how hot Lulu is compared to this, like, frumpy woman in this military outfit and weird Leia hair.
Not a lot of women. Not a lot of character development of women either, so.
Which brings me to the other side of the have your cake and eat it too, and that is Lulu herself. I have a lot of affection for her character. I do think she's very fun. Mila Jovovich's performance is great. She does a good job of injecting humor into this character and doing this kind of, I mean, I think her character is a variation on the, you know, robot trying to be a human type of character. She's obviously not literally a robot, but...
But she's growing up very quickly.
She's growing up very quickly. She doesn't understand how humanity works. She's got this kind of childlikeness to her.
She's sentient, but she's becoming sentient. This takes place over like a couple of days. It's not even, it's not very long.
At a stretch, it's at most 3 days, maybe.
May at the most, yeah.
Yeah, which is why it's like a little bit crazy that it ends with Bruce Willis saying, I love you to Lilu, because they've known each other for a couple of days.
She's very charismatic. He is very alone.
Yes, for sure.
His home is probably not as big as my bedroom.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's very small.
Maybe half the size.
He's got a lot of use of space really well.
Yeah.
Because he's got a lot of stuff in there. He's got a bed. He's got a refrigerator. He's got a stove. I actually, my favorite visual in the whole film is when the Chinese restaurant guy pulls his flying boat up next to the window and serves Corbin, you know.
It's like ramen or something.
Chinese takeout, ramen or something at his window. And they have a conversation and they're talking as they're eating. He's like, he's at a restaurant, but the restaurant has come to him.
Yeah.
And it's flying.
Yeah.
So that's my favorite visual in the whole film.
And I feel like that's the visual that tells me that they are not trying to do a dystopia. He may live in a like micro studio apartment.
He seems to love his life. Oh, there is one other woman. The mother.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Who you never see.
Periodically.
Yeah.
You hear her on the phone. She calls him all the time and bitches at him.
Yep.
About everything. Everything you can imagine is a stereotypical mother.
Yeah.
And I didn't appreciate that. I think
no, I didn't like
left
it.
That completely out.
Yeah.
She's a thorn in his side. You didn't tell me you were going out, you were leaving the planet.
Yeah. And it's not that funny. Yeah. It's not that funny. And it doesn't add
anything to it. Except to maybe give him conflict in his life because he's a happy-go-lucky guy. He doesn't have a lot of conflicts in his life.
It implies that he has more of a life than we're seeing. But apart from that, it really doesn't add anything. And I don't even think that you need that to understand that. Because he also has a conversation with his direct boss in the cab company. And it's clear that they have a relationship. And that seems like a much healthier, less one-sided relationship. Like, it seems like they know each other. He also has a relationship with the guy in the ramen boat. You know, it's clear that they know each other. And they have, like, a delightful little exchange. So, yeah, I think, like, if I were going to change exactly one thing about this movie, I would get rid of the mother. She adds nothing.
The mother, yeah.
And it's not funny. And it's just a sexist stereotype of the nagging mother. But, yeah, but I'm not done talking about Lilu. I mean, she is, like, a big part of this movie. You know, I think on the one hand, like, it's very cool that she gets to be such an action star and that she feels so, like, physically invulnerable for much of the movie. And Mila Jovovich is very fun portraying her. And she's got some good comedic moments, like the famous multipass line. She's very good at delivering that. On the other hand, she is a prime example of the trope known as born sexy yesterday, which I have talked about on the podcast before. She was born yesterday, but she's immediately sexy, immediately objectified, and immediately sexually available to Bruce Willis. Now, that last one, I will say, the only counter to that is there is a moment when he brings her to the priest and she's unconscious and he kisses her. And she responds to that by putting a gun to his head and yelling at him in the divine language. He then asks the priest what she said, and the priest says, "Never without my permission."
So, and that is a very important point in the movie for me.
Yes.
I mean, well, first of all, I would back it up and say that Ian Holm is adorable.
He's great.
When he first sees her and sees that she's a girl.
Yeah.
He's just adorable. But yeah, that scene made me respect this film so much because she says to him, "Not without my permission." And that is something that women have a hard time saying.
Yeah.
You know, men touch us. Men initiate kisses a lot of times. We've talked about this before. That's something that I grew up with, and it's never bothered me to see it in films or television or experience it in real life. It's never bothered me. But as soon as you pointed out to me, I thought, you're right. They should ask permission. And it's funny because in a lot of more modern TV shows, I'm seeing that happen more.
Yeah.
Younger generations or the both partners are asking permission before they kiss. So that's a great scene. In 1987, yeah. it's really early.
And I do think it's important that Bruce Willis's character responds to that by saying, "You're right, I shouldn't have done it." And then even in a separate scene when she's not even around, he says, "I shouldn't have kissed her." And like I do think that's important and good, both because that is the right reaction and also because it's a reaction that is devoid of anger. You know, in that moment, you could view that as her rejecting him, and he doesn't sit there and get like butt hurt and angry about the rejection. He's like, "You're right, I have overstepped." And it doesn't like change the way that he treats her. He continues to treat her with the same affection because she's right, and she's allowed to express her boundaries, and he realizes that he's wrong and that the thing that needs to change is him doing things that would go against her boundaries.
On the other hand, and this is kind of going back to your point about having their cake and eating it too, she is the embodiment of love. Mm-hmm. As the fifth element, they're saying that she is love. So people are attracted to love. And so it kind of makes sense that he was maybe pulled toward her. And that's why the impulse to kiss her grabbed him, because she is.
I mean, maybe
love. We don't know that yet. But what I'm saying is, Luc Besson might have put that in there. That might have been what he was thinking. So that cake and eat it too kind of thing.
Exactly.
He's setting Bruce Willis up for this, but then he's also making her push back against it. It's an interesting part of the movie.
Yeah, I think that her character is full of a lot of contradictions, because like she is consistently objectified throughout the movie. I mean, we haven't explicitly said this, but when she first wakes up, she's naked, and then they put this like quote-unquote thermal bandage suit on her, which is literally just like strips of cloth covering her vulva and her breasts, and like a strip like down her front or whatever. It's like barely clothes. It's
connected.
Barely even underwear.
Yeah, it's not even that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what she does her big escape in. And at the same time, in that room, as I did mention in my summary, all of these dudes are just like sort of salivating over her. They keep like whispering about how perfect she is and staring at her body. And there is this shift where before she has been created, they are talking about her with using male pronouns. They keep saying he, right? Because they think because it's going to be a warrior, it must be a he. And then as soon as they see that it's a woman, it all switches to leering and objectifying just like instantly. And it's a real creepy scene, and it feels like the movie at the same time wants you to be disgusted by these men, but also wants you to enjoy looking at her just the way they are.
When you mentioned that they were expecting a man, I think Luc Besson does also kind of turn expectations on their head several times.
Sometimes,
in the film, they're expecting a man. It's a woman, and she's a beautiful. She's perfection. You know, when we see the Chinese cook in the boat pull up to the window, and it's a reversal of what you would normally do. You would go to a Chinese place and get takeout. You wouldn't have the chef bring it to you and cook it for you at your window. He's turning expectations upside down all the time, and you know, the opera singer has the stones, but he has to cut into her. He has to open her up after she's died to get the stones out. And Zorg as the bad guy that we don't actually dislike. So there are several instances I could probably come up with more if I watch it again, where he's turned expectations on their head. So I like that.
That actually brings me to the other main character that I want to talk about, which is Ruby Rod, who I think is also this very this big flip on expectations. I mean, the
writing in his character is superb.
Yeah.
And Chris Tucker brings it off really well.
He's a fascinating character because, so he is this big radio star, and from that perspective, he kind of makes total sense, because in some ways he's sort of like a shock jock, but not exactly a shock jock, but that kind of big personality. So he makes total sense as this person who whose radio show is basically just him talking, because he talks a mile a minute and the things he says are crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And he's very like over the top.
Are people paying to listen to this?
I mean, yeah, but he's also supposed to be this ladies' man. Before you even see him, I think there are several like background women who express their sexual desire for him, who they think he's so hot. And then you see him and he looks kind of like a drag queen. He's got this crazy white wig on that has what looks like a phallus coming out of the front of it. And he's wearing a skin tight bodysuit in leopard print with this wide open chest piece, the top of it, collar. He's got this big collar that's like open at the top, showing off his chest and the tops of his shoulders, which are very muscular. And so that they're very like this, you know, kind of this beautiful masculine image, except that design is very feminine. You know, it's usually women who have gowns that show off their chest and shoulders. So that the design of his outfit is very feminine, but also it is like calling attention to how masculine his chest and shoulders are. And the way that he walks, he has this extreme sway to his hips, like he's swaying from side to side. I think Chris Tucker has actually talked about how some of the inspiration for his performance was Prince. He's a little bit doing an exaggerated Prince impression.
That's actually who he does look like in the film, except a much more gay,
a much more Prince. Flamboyant.
You said drag culture, but in 1997 it was probably just gay culture.
And I said drag queen. I said he looks like a drag queen because he does.
Okay, drag queen. He was fucking women left and right in the movie.
Yeah, for sure. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. It's this weird contradiction at the heart of his character where. Yeah, on the one hand,
expectations being turned on. Yeah.
Yeah, like all of these women are attracted to him and he's clearly supposed to be a ladies' man, but also he's dressed in skin-tight leopard print bodysuits and like he's got like roses on and he's wearing wigs in every scene, and like if you were to look at him and not know any of the stuff about women, you would assume he was gay. You would absolutely assume he was gay.
Absolutely.
And then, like, the second thing that you see him do is go down on one of the
stewardesses.
Air stewardesses, yeah. He has sex with one of the women in the aircraft. And also, even that, like, it is a sex scene, but it explicitly starts with him performing oral sex on her. So it's not even this, you know, traditionally, usually when you think of, like, a ladies man, he's usually presented as being pretty selfish. And, like, he's getting sexual favors from her. This is flipped on its head. Ruby Rod's, like, his appeal is that he will give pleasure to women, which feels very French to me. but as also just kind of this, like, refreshing twist. As I told my partner, I'm like, for years, the only movie that I could name where you know for a fact that a man performed oral sex on a woman was Fifth Element. It's this scene.
Yeah. Good point. Very good point. And actually, it evolves. They have sex for a period of time because they start off with that, and then after the thing takes off, and everybody has to, you know, lay down and whatever, and go, and she's they're in a bunk together, and her legs are stretched out, and then when the sexual part is over, she drops her legs.
It's a
cutting back and forth between that and other things that are going on.
Yeah, it's cutting back and forth. Effective. It's in the scene when the plane is taking off. So it's cutting back and forth between the plane taking off and the priest sneaking on board, and then that guy getting blown up. I feel like Ruby Rod. I mean, for me, Ruby Rod is a big part of why this movie works. Because Chris Tucker is so fun to watch and he's so funny. So many of his lines are so fucking funny. But also because of this interesting twist to him. He is this womanizer character, but he's also kind of gay. You know, it doesn't necessarily seem like he's the one who gets off on it when he has sex with women. It's the woman who does.
Yeah. But also he's kind of a hero because in the end, when he realizes what they have to do to save the world, he kicks it into gear. And he goes with them and he's like,
and he helps
turns
out.
On a dime. He helps them. He pushes in. He said, what do we have to do? What do we have to do? And they do it together. He's part of the team that saves the world. So for 1997, this is an amazing and robust character like nothing I think we'd ever seen before, except in Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's,
yeah.
Up until then, that's really the only movie, big famous movie, that where we had seen this kind of back and forth.
This flamboyance.
Flamboyant and takes on not pigeonholing people.
Yeah.
They could be whatever they wanted to be. Like, he loves being this flamboyant, kind of outwardly gay guy who loves women.
Yeah.
You know? So it's just a fascinating character. And then he becomes
fascinating,
a hero at the end.
Yeah.
He helps to save the world.
And yeah.
I mean, for 1997, that's a pretty extraordinary story.
Yeah. He also, essentially narrates the second half of the film, because while this is all going on, he is still doing his radio show.
Good point.
So,
good point.
while the action scenes are happening, he's, telling his audience what's going on and, screaming or whatever.
And that's how we know what's going on sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it keeps escalating. And then when they're finally on Zorg's ship and the hotel has exploded, he finally, signs off and he's like, okay, that's my show. News at 7. Turns off the thing and he goes, that was the best damn show I ever did.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. I love this movie.
There is one more thing that I want to talk about just very briefly. This is the other thing that I would remove from the movie. Again, I still love Ruby Rod's character, but I feel like in the year of our Lord 2024, I can't let this go unmentioned. So he has these three sycophant characters who are all black men, and they're all dressed in a way that kind of matches him. I'm on board with all of that. I like their first scene with him where they're all falling over themselves to compliment him, and I feel like that feels very making fun of Hollywood. Yeah, exactly.
It's a celebrity thing.
Yeah, it's a celebrity thing. However, in the scene where the shootout happens, there's a moment where they run after him and one of them calls him master. And I just feel like that sucks.
I did not hear that.
Yeah, it happens very fast. And there's these sycophant characters, which I think if you removed that line, it feels much more like it's commentary on celebrity culture. But I feel it's very written by a white guy that they literally have these guys call him master. So if there were two things that I could remove from the movie, it would be that and the mom stuff. It's an oversight.
Stereotypes and women and black men. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And as much as I love this movie, it is flawed. This is one of the flaws. And it was written by a white guy who I don't think, I think from his perspective, he was being as racially and gender forward as possible just by having a diverse cast. And that's great. But that can only get you so far. He needed some sensitivity writers. He needed someone to tell him, hey, having three black men call someone else master is not a good thing to do, and really kind of undercuts the humor that you're going for here. And wildly unnecessary.
Yeah, and how did that line get past them? I don't know. To think it was deliberate on his part, that he was trying to make a point. And what point is he making?
Maybe he's trying to make a point, but that's the kind of point that you can't do in a blink and you miss it line. That almost needs to be the whole focus of the movie if you're trying to make a point about people, willingly turning themselves into slaves. That would need to be its own movie. It has no place in this movie. And, especially unfortunate because otherwise Ruby Rod is 100% my favorite part of this movie. Chris Tucker is so good in this role.
He's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's a fun movie. And actually, that takes me into hot takes, if you're up for that now.
Yeah, let's do it.
So my first hot take is, who says science fiction can't be fun?
Yeah.
This is a fun movie, and it also makes you think. Not a lot, but a little bit. It's just a lot of fun. I don't think I can... Well, actually, we're talking about maybe doing Galaxy Quest in a few weeks. So that's another one that's a science fiction movie, but it's also fun.
Yeah.
And, maybe science fiction writers take themselves too seriously. So anyway, that's my take on that. But it's also kind of a bleak, ugly, cynical version of our planetary future, despite the flying cars, which I love. It's a police state almost, where you begin to believe that one might actually be needed in this kind of, it's actually also kind of a Western, the flying cars are zooming around And it has a real Western feel to it, you know, and an old Western in the sky with, you know, futuristic cars. I guess it's a little bit of a cautionary tale. When Leeloo tells Corbin that humans are strained, everything you created is used to destroy.
Yeah.
Beautiful things are worth saving. Beauty, love, the opera singer is not saved. She would have been worth saving. And, you know, I think it's a little bit, in my brain, a little bit of a nod to the Star Trek movie, The Voyage Home, which is also about how mistakes made in the past could affect our future. However, we don't really know why these creatures with the burning planet, why they have it in for us. So I'm not even sure I can go there. It's just that's what
I'm not even sure there are creatures there. It's just a big ball of evil.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the Mandalorians.
Okay. The Mangalores.
I'm just going to call them Mandalorians because I can't ever remember what their name is.
They're not technically related to the big ball of evil. They're like a whole separate thing. This is what's crazy about this movie.
That's my question. Who are the bad guys and what was their goal? Is this burning? What's in this burning? I thought they were.
They were hired by Zorg, and Zorg is being paid by the big ball of flame.
Who we don't know what the big ball of flame is.
Yeah, there is a connection there, but the Mangalores are a separate entity from the big ball of flame.
Okay. So, another hot take I have is her orange hair. It's a beautiful color, and in some ways it makes a lot of sense, except for her yellow roots.
Yeah.
Which are at least 2 inches long. And it just, why didn't you just have the orange all the way, go all the way down to her scalp? It doesn't make any sense to me.
I suspect that maybe when we watched it in 1997, maybe like screens weren't good enough to like make that clear. Like this might be an effect of watching it in this year where everything is much more high def. It might not have been that noticeable in the 90s. That is a very intense kind of dye, and maybe they couldn't redo it. And you know, filming takes a certain amount of time. So maybe when they started, she didn't have the roots, but by the time they got to the end, I don't know.
And it is kind of a nod to punk culture too, because she has a very punk look about her, and I like that. And I think it's interesting that we, in this series of films we've done on, you know, science fiction, adventure, thriller type films, almost all of the ones that we have chosen to discuss are today considered classics and iconic. You know, I mean, Alien, Terminator, Jurassic Park, and now The Fifth Element. People look upon these films as classic science fiction movies, and I think that there's a good reason for that. They're all very good films. They all have a message, and the message is there will be a future. But that's a Star Trek film. We don't know what the future is going to be. It may have flying cars. It may have a big burning planet coming towards us.
Yeah.
But it's going to be there. So that's all I got.
Yeah. Well, and The Fifth Element is kind of an interesting case because it is neither a dystopian nor a utopian future. It's kind of just...
Exactly.
What if we continue exactly the same way that we've always been? And we don't get wiped out. We don't wipe ourselves out. We're just as messy and flawed. Yeah. Like we didn't mention this, but in the scene where they're getting the multipass tickets, the background is full of trash. There's just like trash everywhere. And the woman who's giving them their tickets apologizes for it and gives no explanation. There's just a bunch of trash. There's still McDonald's. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels very 90s because it was made in the 90s and so much of the style feels very reminiscent of films at the time, just like much more colorful. That's part of what I like about this movie is that it is this like vision of the future where we have neither destroyed ourselves nor saved ourselves. We're just kind of still limping along.
Limping along. And his, you know, it's funny because Corbin's apartment, I keep coming back to this, and actually I think visually for years and years and years, that apartment has stayed with me in my mind, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not oppressive. It's very small, but it doesn't feel claustrophobic, except for when he sticks the people into the refrigerator and under the bed. But for him, it never really feels, and for us, the viewer, it doesn't really feel claustrophobic. It feels very efficient.
Yeah.
It feels like he's got a lot of space, even though we can tell, but it's very small and it's clean.
Yeah.
It's organized well and it's clean. He keeps it neat. So, you know, his little neat little part of the universe in contrast to the chaos that is right outside his window
yeah.
with these cars zooming past and the buses or the trains or whatever going up and down. And that's something we did. The roller coaster look of the trains that are going up and down the buildings. They're going, you know, vertically instead of, horizontally or, you know, and that's my immediate thought was, roller coasters. How are, are these people living on anti-nausea medication? I mean, this would, you know, this would be horrible for me. Visually, though, the film was just striking in so many ways, and I do appreciate his style as a director.
Yeah,
and it's kind of I'm interested. Actually, I kind of have it on my list now to see La Femme Nikita. I don't know anything about it. It's a more serious film, I think, but I haven't seen it. And a lot, most of his films are in French. This one was actually made in the English language.
So. Yeah. Also, Corbin Dallas has a cat. He lets his cat in the first scene that we see him.
Yes.
She does just kind of disappear from the film after that, but it felt like a moment of like, this is technically the future, but people are still the same. He's got this cat.
It's still
been
the same.
Yeah.
They make the best of what they have. He's got this limited space, but he has made it his own.
Yeah.
He has a feline companion.
Yeah.
He has friends because he's on the phone with friends all the time.
Yeah.
And even the military cops who come to him know him and treat him respectfully and affectionately because he's a likable guy. Nobody's gonna not like Corbin. He's just he's a fun guy.
And the one last note that I wanted to make about the visuals, and I'm gonna see if I can express this in a way that makes sense. I love the visuals, but there is this very weird sense that everything is just kind of a series of disconnected rooms. And I don't know, that might just be a side effect of, you know, the fact that this is a super sci-fi movie that did not have, you know, unlimited budget and unlimited access to CGI. We get very few like establishing shots. And like, as we mentioned before, in New York, there is this feeling that no one is on the ground anymore. And so we end up doing this thing where we just kind of go from room to room and we don't see a lot of the connective space between the rooms. So like we hop from Corbin's apartment over to where the priest is living and you kind of have no sense of how he got there. It's like he just sort of materialized in this other building.
You don't see any outdoor space. You don't see any parks. Mm-hmm. That is not part of this future.
Yeah, and when we go to the spaceship hotel, you don't actually know at first that the hotel is going to be in a spaceship. They make it sound like it's going to like we're going to this pleasure planet, but then it turns out the hotel is a spaceship and we never go down to the planet. So there is this interesting sense that you're never actually on the ground. You're never except in Egypt in the very last scene
except
they're
in
Egypt,
Egypt
which also
The opening and the ending.
But the opening is 300 years ago and is also in Egypt. But there's also this kind of weird, okay, so Brooklyn has continued to build up and up and up into the sky, but somehow Egypt has been perfectly preserved and is still just like this sandy desert.
Well,
interesting.
It leaves questions open because... And why is it Brooklyn is, I mean, and the reason these apartments are so small is because there's so many people.
Yeah.
There's all these buildings that are just like the building he lives in, which means there's a huge population there. Has everybody in the United States gone to live in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
And when you get to Egypt, what's going on there? Are they, there's a lot of questions left unanswered and that's okay.
It's not a complaint. It's just an observation. But so I guess my hot take about the movie is I don't think a movie has to be good to be good, if that makes sense. Like, to be a bit clearer, I don't think a movie has to, like, make sense or be that deep to be a super fun and enjoyable time. You know, like, I've been talking about the themes, and there are definitely, like I said, there are those couple of things that I would change. And, you know, I do think that there could have been a version of this movie where Lilu was not quite so objectified, for sure. Although, that being said, I do think that she's not as objectified as she could be. There are a couple of times where she like randomly strips down. And a lot of other movies would have used that as a moment to linger the camera on her body. But instead, the camera goes to the men around her who are flustered by her decision to do this. And it's kind of used as a moment to point out that she does not have this shame of her body that other people do. Like, to her, she does not understand why people would be weirded out by her just stripping off her clothes. You know, she's got that sort of childlike mentality about it, or not even childlike, but kind of like uncultured. You know, she does not have this cultural sense that we do of like the need to cover up your body. Like I said, the film keeps kind of walking this line and sort of trying to both be progressive, but also give you the sort of vicarious thrill of getting to look at a hot woman's body. It's, you know, it's kind of all over the place. It's very 90s. I think this movie is so exemplary of like where feminist discourse was in the 90s. You know, at the time, this probably seemed like a pretty progressive movie to a lot of people. And I still think that it's very fun to watch. And a lot of it does still hold up, but some of it doesn't. And I guess my other hot take is I think you can have some pretty big criticisms of a movie and still love it. And The Fifth Element is my main example of that. Yeah, like there's definitely stuff to criticize. And if someone says that these things are like a deal breaker for them, I totally get it. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I still love this movie because I mostly just turn my brain off and let Chris Tucker entertain me. You know, so I'm okay with it. But I think it's worth discussing. It's worth discussing these odd tensions in this movie that is not trying to be that deep and doesn't need to be that deep, but still somehow accidentally highlights these weird contradictions in our culture.
I think that's true of all the movies that we have watched, that they aren't perfect.
Yeah.
We think they're about as close as you can come for the most part to perfect. They all had questions. We've nitpicked at them in a few times. And in fact, Jurassic Park, we spent a lot of time picking apart stuff. Even though we love that movie, it's both of our favorite movies. So, and I had forgotten how much I liked this movie until I watched it again. I'm really glad we did this one for the podcast.
Yeah. All right. I think that's it.
That, dear listeners, is all for today. This has been Woman Inherits the Earth, a discussion podcast about women in movies from the perspective of a mother and daughter.
I'm Tessa Dare. You can find me at my website, tessadare.com, where you can sign up for my email list, or you can follow me on Instagram and Threads at author.tess.adare, or you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/womaninheritstheearth.
And I'm Beth Von Baron. You can follow me on Instagram at STL_writer_Beth, or sign up for my weekly Substack email, Saturday Morning Musings, at STLWriterBeth.substack.com. Until next time,
Multipass!